Thank you, Jeff, and thank you for asking me on.
This book has been, I guess it really hasn't been in the works since you completed the first one?
Yeah, you know, I've been working on this for a good 2 years, probably going on 3 years. After I wrote the first book, I thought I was through with the subject. And then people began inquiring about a sequel. And I didn't begin a sequel right away. Instead, as you know, I did a second book entitled Kundalini Tales,
right,
dealing with mind control and paranormal topics. And then this was kind of on the back burner, but I continued to accumulate documentation and evidence and continued to talk to people. And after a while, I accumulated another stack of documentation that attained critical mass. And I kind of looked at it one day and said to myself, well, that looks like there's just about another book and all of that there.
At least. In other words, what you're saying is that documentation grabbed you by the neck and said, Richard, time to work on me.
There you go. And, you know, here I have, this is the third book now, and I'm already kicking around in my mind schemes for a fourth and a fifth and a sixth book. So I guess maybe I've gotten hooked on writing these things. But, you know, looking at this underwater and underground bases, I have to say, myself, having written it, I flip through it and say, my goodness, how bizarre, how strange. But, you know, after the research I've done and given the people I've talked to over the last several years, I now have a much different view of reality on this planet and also beneath the surface of it than I used to. And I promise you, those of you listening, that if you read this book, and Lord help you, if you read this book and the other two, you also will have a different view of reality.
That's funny. You know, the amazing thing is how we all think about space and up there, when in reality, it's probably just as active and just as exciting, if not more so, in terms of masses of men, material, and equipment, and women, of course, in these underground installations and in the plans and in the building and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and you know, this is, you bring up an interesting point that became clear to me a number of years ago. When we think about these secret clandestine activities, I think often we tend to assume that these are exclusively male conceived and male carried out. But indeed there are more and more females involved in these types of activities too, whether they're in industry or in various government or military agencies or in other organizations that may be neither in the corporate sector, neither in the corporate sector nor the governmental sector.
Sure.
There are, you know, and think about it. Who better than a woman in many cases to be involved in these activities because of the biases that so many of us in the culture carry along with us. Oftentimes women are least suspected of being involved in these kinds of things. But as we know from this flap with the so-called Navy spy plane that was detained in China for a couple of weeks, there were three women on that plane.
That's right.
And I'm sure that there are a lot of women doing many very highly strange and exotic things, including serving in and perhaps even helping to construct these very clandestine and extremely deeply buried facilities.
And no comments about the nesting instinct either that makes women more suited for this kind of work.
Well, I don't know. You know, this is another thing that it came true to me, became clear to me during the research, and it was explicitly stated in one of the documents, the idea of having crews and their families stationed in these very elaborate, very deep submarine installations. I'm not talking about a submarine in the sense of a submersible vehicle, but submarine installations that are maybe hundreds or even thousands of feet below the seafloor in mid-ocean. And I had never considered before, my God, there might actually be, or suppose there are, a very secretive groups of people living in very deeply buried facilities, whether they're under the continental shelf out offshore, or whether they're onshore in the middle of the continent but very deeply buried. How long might people stay down there? Might they stay down there so long that they become troglodytes, so to speak, and actually raise families? Might there be children who are first and maybe even second generation in these facilities? I don't know, Jeff, but as I have conducted this research, as I have accumulated more and more documentation, as I have become aware of an enormous degree of secrecy surrounding so much of this activity, I've had to wonder if there might not be this sort of parallel society in which people reside perhaps more or less permanently deep underground or deep undersea, and coming amongst our topside society maybe rarely, or in some cases maybe even never. I don't know, but it has occurred to me, that question has occurred to me as I have worked with this material over the last few years.
You are, and I should tell our listeners, Richard was on the program years ago doing his first book, of course, and he is not one. He doesn't like to speculate. This is unusual for him to speculate even tonight. I know him well enough. He's a by-the-book, hard-data kind of a researcher. So if to hear Richard talk about this, I can't wait to read the book. I have thumbed through it, but I haven't been able to read it.
I'm saying is I'm raising this issue right now because I found a specific mention in a rather extensive document that I cite at some length in the second half of the book, and that's an official United States Navy document that itself explicitly raised the possibility of quartering crews and their families in very deeply buried massive installations in mid-ocean, hundreds or even thousands of feet beneath the seafloor. So what I'm saying, Jeff, is that I'm raising this line of speculation on your program this evening because I saw it, the issue or the idea explicitly mentioned in an official United States Navy document that I cite very prominently in the second half of my book. So I want to put that in context.
Very good. All right. It is indeed in context now. The book is Underwater and Underground Bases, the sequel by Richard Sauder. That's Sauder, Ph.D., author, of course, of Underground Bases and Tunnels, what the government is trying to hide. What is the government trying to hide? And the order number, I'm going to give it to you now and then repeat it a couple of times. It's real simple. 1-800-718-4514. 800, toll-free, 718-4514 for Underwater and Underground Bases by Richard Sauder, Ph.D. Be right back. Lots of questions. We're going to touch on many topics covered in great detail in this book, which is really utterly unique on the planet. No one else has been there and done this, as has Richard Sauder.
The Fascinating Talk continues with Jeff Rentz after these messages. Welcome back to the most intriguing nighttime talk on radio with Jeff Rentz.
Before we get into the meat of the book here, at least we're going to take a look at some of the heavier duty aspects of it. This book is so well researched, as are all Richard's books, that you just can't put it away. He goes back 20, 25 years and pulls up reports projecting this and projecting that, and then watches what happens very carefully, looking for indications that these reports, in fact, were put into process. Before I do that, though, Richard, what is it about going underground that is so appealing to people? What is it, the psychology of it all? There is some psychology here. I mean, I think that it represents to some people maybe the cave bear thing genetically, maybe safety, security. I'm not sure what it is, but there is some underground psychology that drives a lot of this, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, we bandy about the term depth psychology. We talk about the schools of psychology that Jungian psychology, for example, Jungian analysis or Freudian analysis, and it does appear that in the depths of the human psyche, one of the drives we have is a burrowing drive. Burrowing activities have been done by many human societies over the years. And of course, in ancient times, we have the idea of cave people going deep underground in caverns to live and to carry out religious ceremonies. For example, it appears Cro-Magnon man did that in Europe, mm-hmm. in the caves at Altamira, for example, and in Spain. So this drive to go underground, to get deep underground, appears to be a very deep and ancient part of the human psyche. It certainly hasn't gone away in recent years. If anything, it's only become more pronounced and more high-tech.
My view is that it's really more potent than the drive to go out there.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a powerful drive, there's no doubt. And what we see in the case of these very powerful organizations, such as major government agencies, Fortune 500 companies and so forth, is that you have people that have this drive but couple it with some of the most powerful technology that human beings have ever developed.
Right.
And you wed those two, and you can make some powerfully large and deep tunnels, and you can make some very sophisticated and extremely deeply buried facilities, and that is happening, and it has been going on now for decades. And my
That's
research,
capital D, folks, decades is
decades. Oh yes, we're talking
time.
A half a century or more. And I think the average person doesn't fully appreciate the great power and size of these pieces of machinery that are used for underground construction and excavation. Just gargantuan, these tunnel boring machines, and I have pictures of some of them in my book.
You do.
In both the first book and also in the third book here. But they can be 300 feet or more in length. In terms of diameter of the cutting head, they can range anywhere from 5 to 8 feet all the way up to 50 feet or more in diameter. We're talking about the capability to make truly gargantuan tunnels and miles long, hundreds and even thousands of feet underground. This is the state of the art in underground tunneling technology, and the average person simply does not experience this type of powerful machinery within the context of his or her everyday life. And so has no...
Yeah. Nor do you see them on the evening news.
No, not too much, no. I don't know if I've ever seen a real live tunnel boring machine on the news.
Nope.
And you don't see them often in magazines either. But they're very real. They're used all over the place. They've been in use for a good half century now. And I have pictures of some of them in my book.
Yep.
Of course, most of the tunnels that are made are for perfectly ordinary civil engineering projects, like for aqueducts or subways, railroad tunnels, sewer tunnels, that kind of thing. However, that same technology can be used and is used for other purposes, for clandestine tunneling. And we have evidence of that. We just don't know exactly where all of the tunnels are, but are there some clandestine tunnels? Yes, I've done enough research at this point. I've talked to enough people, and I have a pretty good idea where I would look for them. It's just that it's very hard to feasibly detect something that's thousands of feet underground.
It is indeed.
That brings up another reason for going underground: out of sight, out of mind. The secrecy aspect is a very large part of this.
So many people have reported rumbling under their houses, under their feet, sounds, actually the noise of what sounds like blasting underground. You know, we've heard the stories on this show. You certainly know them more than I do. And
I don't know if I know them more than you do, but I've certainly heard some of them. And there, as you observe, there are many people who, over the years, have reported these.
Something's going on underneath.
These rumblings underground. These the sounds of heavy machinery. Some people sometimes report hearing underground. I'm inclined to believe that my research has revealed only the tip of the iceberg. And, Jeff, my research has revealed quite a lot.
Yes, it has. And a quick glance at the book shows that this is, again, a book you've got to read. This is the forgotten, I think, territory of so-called alternative news. And I don't want to use the word. We'll leave it at that. This is forgotten science. It's way down there. It's amazing, and it's real, and by the way, we're paying for it, in case anybody asks. There are some private companies, though, who do their own, but by and large, these are often black ops, military, and so forth. Be right back with Richard and continue our discussion.
Jeff Rentz will be right back following these messages on the Talk Radio Network.
Oh, what a topic. What a book. Boy, does it open 100 doors of amazing potential once you go through it and look at the data. This is hard data. Underwater and Underground Bases by Richard Sauder, S-A-U-D-E-R, Ph.D. Once again, the phone number. Order this book, 1-800-718-4514, 800-718-4514, or you can online get them, all three of Richard's books. Just go to SauderZone.com. Great name. www.sauderzone, SauderZone.com. They are all there. One more thing before we leave the boring machines themselves. The mechanics involved are pretty much traditional. They're grinding, they're cutting, and so on and so forth. But there are some hybrid technologies and advanced technologies, including high heat, where it actually melts the rock and actually extrudes the melted rock into crevices and cracks as the machine moves through hard rock, bedrock, as it were, leaving an almost obsidian polished glass tunnel behind. Do we know if that technology has ever been actually employed and deployed, Richard?
Well, you know, there are many stories about that, and I cover this in my first book. I actually provide the United States patents that were granted for those machines.
Right. And they go back to the 70s, don't they?
Yes, the late 70s, early 80s. The question is whether those are in secret use. Now, the research, the basic engineering research for that technology was done at Los Alamos National Labs in northern New Mexico back in the 1970s and early 1980s. Whether or not those machines have been secretly constructed or in clandestine use remains an open question for me at this time. They may be, they equally may not be. I simply don't know. However, as you observe, there are indeed stories circulating that I've read and perhaps you've heard that machines such as this are in use. If they're in use, the thing that they would do, as you have mentioned, is to make a very hard, glass-like, vitrified, obsidian-like lining for the tunnel, which would be very handy for keeping water out of the tunnel, for example,
right,
and would also make a very nice structural support for the tunnel as the machine moves along.
Like putting an artery or something underground.
Yeah. Yeah, whether or not those machines are in use, for sure, the garden variety electrically powered mechanical machines are in use, and there are plenty of those in use, and they do suffice to make tunnels, if necessary, many miles in length, hundreds, and even they can bore thousands of feet underground. So, even the so-called conventional technology, if you see it up close and in person, I guarantee you, will appear like something out of a science fiction movie.
Yeah,
I have,
yeah.
if you look on in my book, I have a picture actually of the on page 156. If you have the book there, Jeff,
got it right
of
here.
Of the one of the tunnel boring machines.
Oh, for the English Channel.
Used to bore the channel, and if you look at the size of that puppy, is it mammoth, Jeff?
I can't even imagine looking at this.
It's folks, astonishingly huge.
Well, this is bigger, I think, than a 747 fuselage underground mounted on some rail system. It is absolutely monstrous.
And the tail end of it just vanishes in the distance out of view in this tunnel that stretches out of sight to the rear.
Yeah.
It's just monstrous. These things are gargantuan. And the power of this machinery and the capabilities that these devices have is mind-boggling.
How much can they do? Now, this is an utterly subjective and ridiculous question, but mm-hmm. let's just for the sake of discussion give our listeners an idea of one of these large machines and its capability to make progress, let's say in a 24-hour period, assuming it could work most of the time. How much could it move? Depending on the rock, of course.
This is not speculation. I actually provide the hard data for this. This is a question that, of course, the underground mining and tunneling industry has a keen interest in, because they actually have to drive these tunnels. And the figure that I came up with for the state of the art is in bad rock, that fractured rock that's highly unfavorable for tunneling.
Uh-huh.
A skilled crew with a good machine can make about 5 miles per year. In good rock or in other material that's favorable for tunneling, it's no problem to do 10 or 15 miles per year.
Wow.
So if you have the luxury of a little time, and even a fleet of tunnel boring machines, you can see that actually in practice, you could really make hundreds of miles of tunnels if you had several machines and good rock to work with, say over a decade's time in a 10-year period. Say you could make an average of 10 to 15 miles per year. Let's say that's 12.5 miles per year, and you do that for 10 years. One machine could do 125 miles in one decade. Suppose you had 10 machines and a crew of 20 men.
That's halfway across the country.
Oh, in 10 years.
Yeah.
No problem. In 10 years. Is the money available to do something like that on the sly? You bet it is.
Yeah.
And I also discuss the funding aspect in this book. I go into detail in that as well. So is it possible to drive clandestine tunnels using these tunnel boring machines and a crew, really, if you had even several dozen trained men or women, could you make hundreds of miles or even thousands of miles of secret tunnels? Jeff, yes. The answer is yes, you could.
We have heard rumors over the year, about tunnel systems. You've heard them, we've heard them, a lot of our listeners at home have heard them, some haven't, but there is said to be a system of tunnels linking Area 51, Los Alamos, other secret bases and locations, Los Angeles, you name it. And there is, as Richard has said, no reason to think that this could not have been done some time ago, 10 years ago even, 15 years ago. These machines have been around for that long.
Jeff, even 30 or 40, even 45 years ago.
My. Well, there you go. So it is not crazy to say, what if a black ops or a CIA or an NSA high-level agent wanted to go to Area 51 and he or she was in L.A.? He could go to a building, go down into a basement, take another elevator down, catch a tunnel with a maglev train on it, and be at Area 51 in 30 minutes, 20, 30 minutes.
Mind you, at this stage in my research, that is speculation. However, it is well-founded speculation. What my research clearly shows, and I explicitly discuss in all of my published writings, is that, number one, these stories exist in the culture. You'll see them on internet websites. you'll hear them not only in this conversation that we're having, but I've heard them elsewhere on the radio, on talk shows. You will see it in some magazines. I've read articles like this over the years. And so when I first ran across these stories more than 10 years ago now, I thought they were very strange, and I wanted to look into them to see if there could be any truth to these rumors that I was hearing. And what I have discovered in the intervening time is that, in an interim period, is that the technology certainly exists to do this. The money is certainly available in the black budget. The government agencies, private corporations with the expertise, and more than the expertise, the reasons, the motivations for doing this exist. So I have to say it's within the realm of possibility.
You bet. You bet. And why wouldn't they do this?
Well, I think they very possibly might.
Yep. And the question is, how much money do the black ops folks get? How much is available to them?
Tens of billions per year.
Answer, as much as they need. Be right back with Dr. Richard Sauter and his remarkable new book. This is a mind bender, folks. Underwater and underground bases. Okay, here's a little snippet from Richard's book. This is chapter 3. In 1985, Robert Salter of Litton Industries presented a paper, this is 16 years ago, for Tunneling Underground, Transport, and Macro Engineering Conference, sponsored by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in which he forthrightly advocated, he wasn't beating around the bush here, the construction of a deep underground transcontinental tunnel system. Salter, so might be a relative of yours.
I don't think so.
I'm just kidding. We were just missing two letters. Salter advocated constructing these tunnels as routes through which high-speed magnetic levitation trains would travel at supersonic speed, crossing the continent in less than 1 hour. His paper included an illustration that depicted a system of underground maglev tunnels stretching from coast to coast, spanning the North American continent. He advocated constructing the underground tunnels in 25-mile segments, such as that 100 individual segments, or 100 tunnel boring machines, as Richard has pointed out, would be required and would do the excavation, and they would join these tunnels together to form one continuous 2,500-mile-long tunnel. 16 years ago, doable, could have been already done, folks. We don't know. It's that kind of technology that was presented by Robert Salter of Litton in 1985.
Yeah, see, and if you did 100 segments simultaneously, using that average figure of, say, 10 miles per year,
you could
do the thing in 3 years, Jeff.
Wow.
You could do, I mean, I'm talking about what would be within the capability of industry. Now, has it been done? I don't know. But could it be done? Oh, yeah, you bet.
My money's on the fact that we got a lot of things underground. I think yours is, too. And when you just look at the pictures in Richard's book of these tunnels left behind by these extraordinary machines, again, which were patented 25, 30 years ago in some of their earlier prototypes. Well, a prototype, they were working models. These are amazing pieces of engineering that, just as you said, Richard, don't even make popular mechanics very often.
No,
you just don't see them.
There's so much that is not mentioned in the mainstream press, in the mainstream media. I'm back to this old mantra with respect to these subterranean facilities, out of sight, out of mind. And, you know, the press corps, I don't know about the rest of the world, but the press corps here in the United States these days is pretty well bought and sold. And they just don't inquire into much of anything that they feel is not in favor.
Boy, a very elegant understatement, Richard. I salute you.
Yeah, well, I mean, read your daily paper, and you're not going to read anything much in your daily paper like what you're going to read in this book. So if you really want to have a broader perspective on what's happening, you need to read literature such that I produce and other authors who appear on your show produce in order to have a better rounded view of what's really happening.
If we know, I have the best, I'm not boasting, I am so honored. I have the best audience in radio, Richard. Probably the best audience that has ever been involved with a radio program. This is a smart, well-informed, open-minded, creative-thinking group of people who send email that is so intelligent and so right on the money. Even if they don't agree with some of the program guests, these people think and they hear you loud and clear. 1-800-718-4514 for Richard Sauter's amazing book, Underwater and Underground Bases. We're going to talk about the underwater aspect in the next hour. Have about 5 minutes left in this first hour, Richard. What do you want to touch on?
Well, I want to touch on a little bit this funding aspect. I know you said Walter Berrien is going to be on in the last hour of the program this evening. And I think if you look at some of the work he's done and the astonishing sums of money that he's talking about, you know, sometimes I have people ask me, well, Richard, if there's this clandestine excavation going on underground, how is it paid for? Well, I would suggest that the audience, it would behoove the audience, those who can stay up to listen to Walter later this evening, listen to him carefully and think about the large sums of money that he's going to discuss. And then place the underground construction that I'm talking about in that context, and you will quickly and easily realize that there is plenty of money to be shoveled by the bushels into these clandestine high-tech holes in the ground.
Yeah.
Funding
There's
for
no
this
problem.
Type of activity is no problem.
No, they got as much as they need. Don't kid yourselves. And it's all out of our pocketbooks. And thank you for the mention about Walt. I think I was, in fact, I was the first person to have the opportunity to have Walter on national radio, maybe on radio period, to talk about this whole comprehensive annual financial report. Trillions of dollars being hidden from all of us, folks, all of us, hidden that we own. It's disgusting, to say the least.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you're having him on this evening, of all possible evenings. It's really ironic, the incredible wealth that's being extorted from the population at large, completely needlessly, and what it serves to do is keep the masses of people in a state of really servitude when you get right down to it.
Sure.
Really chained to the grindstone. Forget about your nose to the grindstone. No. People are actually chained to the axle of the grindstone.
Leg irons.
No doubt. Yeah. By the millions and tens and hundreds of millions, the planet over, not only here in the United States, and this really economic oppression we have goes hand in glove with these underground activities. I speculate a little bit in the closing pages of this book as to what might be really going on in some of these clandestine facilities. And, you know, the more I work with this material, the larger questions I have in this regard. And I do speculate about some possible uses. Mm-hmm. And we could talk a little about that in the second hour if you like, Jeff.
Sure.
But I have some real foreboding about the agendas that are being carried out in these highly secretive facilities. The great amount of subterfuge and stealth, the high degree of secrecy that surrounds these activities leads me to believe that many of the things that are going on are almost certainly not good for us at all.
Tend to agree with you 100%. And in our last couple of minutes here, just for fun, let's consider, and you've done so much marvelous work with all of those Mars images, Richard's images. There's must be, how many sections do you have now printed and posted on my website?
I think 15 or 16. I'll have another one for you in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
the lies that are being told by NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and by Malin Space Science Systems are just egregious. Folks, there's a lot on Mars that we're being lied about, too, and they're covering up so much. I've seen enough to know, for it's visible to my eyes, there's life on Mars. Now I can see it in the photos that I have found and that some other people have found. There are clearly massive ruins on Mars. Who or what built them and when, I don't presume to know, but to my eye, they're very clear.
And the whole idea of underground on Mars is more than viable.
I think so. I think there are probably things underground on Mars. And you'll notice the Odyssey spacecraft that lifted off last week and that will arrive in Mars orbit in October of this year has a very sophisticated thermal imaging camera on it.
And folks?
Well, one of the things you can do is to take photographs, thermal photographs, and look for subterranean heat sources.
Oh, it's just geology, Richard.
That's right. They're just looking for hot springs.
That's right. That's right.
I guarantee you that if there would be subterranean facilities on Mars, they would certainly show up in the infrared range.
You got it. And don't watch the left hand, folks. Watch what the right hand is doing. We'll
there you
be
go.
Right back with Dr. Richard Sauter, Ph.D. And again, his phone number is 800-718-4514 for this unprecedented new book, Underwater and Underground Bases. And if you want to go online and pick it up right now, S-A-U-D-E-R, SauterZone.com. Just click right below Richard's name and you are there. We'll be right back with another hour. In fact, two more hours as we pass through the top of the hour. See you on the other side shortly.